This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, in for Joshua Johnson. Characterizations of the South are often sweeping and stereotypical. But if you're outside the South, how can you really get to know the region? Especially as fewer of us make the time and space to get to know one another outside of social media. The first question was of chief concern to landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, who created some of the U.S.'s most famous public parks. Olmsted is lesser known, however, as an undercover correspondent for the New York Times in the American South during the 1850s. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Tony Horowitz spent the past 2 years retracing Olmsted's steps across the South for his new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. Horowitz travels the South in the name of understanding how social dynamics have changed and what continues to divide us as a country. Tony Horowitz joins us now from a studio at Austin's NPR member station, KUT. Tony, hello. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We'd love to hear from you, too. Are you from the South or considered yourself a Southerner? What do you wish other Americans knew about your region or perhaps would stop characterizing it in certain ways? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email us at 1A@WAMU.org. Now, Tony, your new book is a work of journalism, history, and travelogue. Tell us what you were hoping to achieve with retracing Frederick Law Olmsted's journey across the South.
Well, first, I wanted to understand this peculiar genius, Frederick Law Olmsted, who at this point in his life is a bit at sea. He's a farmer, an aspiring writer. He hasn't yet become a landscape architect. And I wanted to see how he went from that point to Central Park through his Southern travels. He's still writing up his Southern material when he begins at Central Park. And I was also struck by the relevance of his mission. He wanted to go South to see it firsthand rather than through Northern stereotype, and to see if there was common ground for reasoned discourse, particularly over slavery, which at this point in the 1850s is pulling the country apart. And I thought it would be interesting to take a parallel journey on his path in our own divided time.
Now, Tony, before we get too far, for those who might not be familiar, who is Frederick Olmsted?
Yeah, he's known as America's greatest landscape architect, best known for Central Park, but he designed many other parks around the country, early suburbs, campuses, Capitol grounds, you name it. He really created much of the urban and suburban landscape that Americans still inhabit.
Now, he's most popular for designing the grounds of New York City's Central Park, the U.S. Capitol building, the Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and others. Now, tell us about his work with the New York Times specifically. Why was he brought on to be a Southern correspondent?
Yeah, the New York Times had just opened shop, and it wanted to be the sort of temperate and moderate voice of its day at a time when newspapers were very partisan and overheated. And they wanted a correspondent to go South and really give factual, fair-minded reporting. And Olmsted fit that bill. He's this kind of hard-headed Connecticut Yankee, calls himself an honest growler. And he really wanted to gather facts that he hoped would provide ballast to the very angry debate between North and South at this time.
You also write in the book that Olmsted wrote that he wanted to gather matter-of-fact matter. What did he mean by that?
Well, at this point, Uncle Tom's Cabin has just appeared, and in reply, Southerners have written what Olmsted calls spoony fancies, sort of defenses of the South that were very flowery. And there was, at that time, not much factual reporting on the South. It tended to be sentimental novels or, paeons to kindly masters and, happy servants. And he wanted to get past all that and see what was really happening on the ground.
Now, Tony, we're discussing the way things are reported across division lines in our country. The new Alabama abortion ban we just covered at the top of the hour has drawn a lot of attention and vitriol from across the country. This includes some stereotypical, divisive language about the South. Characterizations like characterizations like backwards, for example. Mm-hmm. Even the New York Times put out a piece over the weekend. They were talking about millennials moving south and now having to face a backward nature. This mm-hmm. isn't new for the region, of course. You know, what did you hear mm-hmm. about this sort of othering and how it's touched the places and people that you explored?
Yeah, there's a long history to that. Even before Olmsted traveled in the 1850s, there were outsiders from the North in Europe who would essentially go on southern safaris to what they saw as this exotic, sultry, backward land filled with strange creatures. And in a sense, that's never stopped, and it's something certainly I hoped to avoid. And I think as your opening report showed, you know, we can't talk about one South or one Alabama. Many people were opposed to this bill. And I think we should always be careful to not treat the South as some sort of monolith. We're talking now in this day of a region of over 100 million people with tremendous diversity. And I think that's perhaps something you hear most often traveling the South, of people feeling both condescended to, but also stereotyped, particularly by Hollywood.
Now, Katie wrote us on Twitter saying, simply put, the South is about systemic inequality, whether it is women's rights, policing and incarceration, public and private schools. Even if a neighborhood has sidewalks, Southern culture is still based on the idea that some are better than others. Is that accurate?
I think we have to be sure. There is terrible inequity in the South, and I talk about that in my book. But there is in other parts of the country, too. And I think we, again, have this long tradition of treating the South as an evil twin on which we project what are really national sins, whether it's inequality or violence or lack of education. So certainly we need to focus on the problems you described in Alabama prisons, but not treat it purely as a Southern thing, because segregation, for instance, is now more pronounced in northern cities such as Chicago and New York than it is in southern cities.
And that's one of the issues that you wanted to address with your journalism as well. Isn't that right, Tony?
Sure.
What about your title of the book, Spying on the South? I imagine plenty of Southerners would bristle at such a title, considering the history of Northerners coming to observe Southerners. Why would you choose this title?
It's a reference first to Olmsted's mission. He's not a spy in a military sense, but he's traveling incognito at a time when Northern travelers were often treated as abolitionist snoops and stirrers. He writes under the pen name Yeoman, and he's essentially gathering intelligence on what's soon to become enemy territory with the Civil War. I'm certainly not traveling in that fashion, but in the opening scene of the book, a barmaid in West Virginia takes one look at me and says, I get it, Yankee boy spying on us hillbillies. So the title was actually a bit of a gentle joke at myself as well.
I see. And now, this is not a new tradition, the fly-in reporter to southern states, right?
Not at all. As I said, they weren't fly-ins because they couldn't travel by that means. But there have been, you know, travelers and travelogues about the South since at least the early 1800s and continuing ever since, this fascination with this region and, you know, treating it as almost a nation apart. And yeah, I certainly didn't want to do a fly-in or a drive-by. I spent the better part of 2 years traveling the South for this book.
Which is a long time. Joanna wrote us on Facebook. She says, I am convinced that men hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. And they don't know each other because they don't communicate with each other. She's, of course, quoting the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And she says, I am generally not a fan of bars, but I'm very glad to hear about people who keep trying to have human-level conversations across divides.
Yeah. Olmsted wrote that his best sources in the South were ordinary people that he could take a glass of toddy with at the bar, preferably not a fancy bar, third-rate taverns. And I certainly did a lot of that in my book, but also went to churches, workplaces, homes, barbecues, where the strongest drink on offer was sweet iced tea. But bars are a particularly good place to get past our barriers. You're just the guy on the next bar stool, talking one-on-one. rather than through stereotype or through social media. And I found in those settings that we can still talk about our differences in a civil fashion rather than simply shouting at each other. So I do think as a society, we all need to struggle to do more of that, to reach out of to people who aren't like us or may think differently from us and escape our precincts.
1A did a show on this topic called Elegies and Effigies, Who Speaks for Appalachia, in response to the many individuals in national media who were speaking for the region, characterizing it and Trump supporters from the outside. You can access that hour from our website, the1a.org. One of you left us a message in our inbox about making efforts to talk with people with differing political beliefs. This is Jacob from Evansville.
I have gone out of my way to speak with people who don't agree with me or may agree with me. I've canvassed for multiple politicians, and sometimes the people who agree with you most, or the people who disagree with you most, or the people who fall in the middle, will have perfectly wonderful and pleasant conversations with you because they just want to express their political beliefs and they don't feel like anybody is listening to them. So not everybody is a racist bigot. Not everybody is a homophobe. People just want people to listen to where they are. And they're perfectly pleasant. That's been my experience.
Thanks, Jacob. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A. Tony, how did you approach this process as an outsider? You write about this in your book, but there were times you were not always welcome.
Those times were very rare, and the South is not entirely new territory to me. I wrote a book 20 years ago, Confederates in the Attic, about memory of the Civil War today and all the debate about flags and monuments. I was traveling different parts of the South this time, including a lot of time in Texas, where I am now. And I would second what the call-in you just had said, that I can really count on one hand the number of times I was treated with personal animus when I walked in to a bar or any other place with a spiral reporter's notebook and basically announced that I'm a visiting writer from Massachusetts and want to ask you about immigration, race, other hot-button issues. And, you know, often I heard views I strongly disagreed with, but, you know, that didn't prevent us from having a perfectly civil interchange as people.
Aaron asks us on Facebook, why do so many people feel the need to try to understand people who live in rural areas, while no one feels the need to try to understand people in urban areas? What do you say to that?
I think that, you know, absolutely a fair comment. I think, you know, we do, or I hope the media and writers try to do that. And I think particularly at this time, because one thing that was very striking to me in terms of change in the 20 years since I wrote Confederates in the Attic is the tremendous demographic and other change, particularly in southern cities, immigration from abroad, but also from other parts of the country. So that there were, you know, many particularly upscale parts of New Orleans or Nashville or Houston that have now more in common with northern cities than with a small town an hour away. If you were to drive out of Nashville or Houston or New Orleans for an hour, you would find a very different setting. So I think the rural-urban divide is perhaps more meaningful than the regional one, whether it's north and south or, you know, coast and interior. So obviously, we need to pay attention to all aspects of our society.
I'm going to get through a couple more of our listener comments. Charlie wrote us on Facebook. He said, one thing that stuck out to me the first time I traveled to the South was how good race relations seemed to be. And James emailed us. He says, it's full down here, hotter than a pistol. Roaches big enough to put a saddle on and ride. Swarms of mosquitoes that'll suck out your last drop of blood. Hurricanes with tornadoes that will carry your house and car away. And floods bad enough that some days you won't know whether to drive your car or boat to work. So y'all stop coming because you won't like it. Did you experience any of that?
certainly some of the
Some of the mosquitoes.
Heat and the insects. And I took some rather rough adventures on this trip, including a mule trip in Texas and riding on a coal barge in, on the Ohio River. So I certainly experienced the elements firsthand. On race, I'll just speak about it in the context of the debate over Confederate monuments, for instance, which is current. And again, I've seen tremendous change in the 20 years since I really traveled in depth the last time. I find that younger people are simply not invested in the Confederacy and its symbols in the way that their parents or grandparents were really marinated in the lost cause. And also because if you've had this tremendous demographic change, there are many more people from outside the South who live in the South now who have no tie to this legacy. And my sense is, you know, most people want to move on. And there's still, you know, plenty of diehards out there when it comes to, you know, monuments or the rebel flag. But I think they're an aging and diminishing minority.
Now, you mentioned your mule rides a moment ago, but tell us more about the journey. You traveled Appalachia, the Bayou, and you ended in the Lone Star State. What were the overlapping themes from Olmsted's travelogue and your travels you encountered around the topic of slavery?
Yeah, so I was really following the path of one of his southern journeys, because he took two, very closely. And I also wanted to travel whenever possible, as he did, by train, by riverboat. He rode stagecoaches and then in the saddle, which is how I ended up on a mule trip. And yes, ending inside Mexico, where he went to interview fugitive slaves. One of the kind of ironies is in that day, slaves from Texas would escape south to freedom, chased by slave patrols. And today, you know, of course, we have immigrants fleeing the other way, being chased by border patrols. So I found some eerie resonances there. You know, I tried to look at the same themes that he did, including landscape, which is of particular interest to him. You know, the story of race is not what it was in the 1850s, thank gosh. You know, the issue isn't slavery. But again, I would say it's very uneven. You see, in my view, tremendous progress in urban areas and in the presentation of slavery at plantations and other historic sites. It's a very different picture if you're in a, you know, small town or village in a rural area.
Okay, so we'll continue. Coming up, we'll get into Olmsted's hope for more democratic spaces. More next with author Tony Horwitz, author of Confederates in the Attic and the new book Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. Stay with us. We're discussing the new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide, with journalist and author Tony Horwitz. Let's continue. Now, Tony, you were talking earlier about younger folks and just sort of the disinterest. Do you think this trend of loss of interest in upholding the lost cause will continue into the future?
Yeah, I think it will. And again, demographics being the driver, both the aging of a generation that clung to this in the way that many earlier generations had, and the increasing influx of people from elsewhere in the country. I mean, I'm at the moment in Texas, where the growth in the Austin and San Antonio area and in between and other parts of the state is just explosive. And you find that in some other parts of the South. So I think this trend can only continue.
And you traveled the South, as you mentioned, 20 years ago for your bestseller, Confederates in the Attic. When it comes to relics and ongoing life and interest in breathing life into the lost cause of the Confederacy, what has changed, do you think?
To me, the most striking change was when I visited slave plantations 20 years ago. Slavery was almost the S word. It wasn't stated. Guides would talk about servants and then go back to talking about the furnishings and the gardens. That still happens at some sites, and I describe it in this book. You know, you get the kind of hoop-skirted Southern Fried, Gone with the Wind presentation. But then you go just down the road to the next plantation, and the slave cabins will be front and center, and there will be a very frank and graphic presentation of slavery. And this is true, really, I find, across the South. It's not everywhere. There are still places that do it as they've always done, but I think it's a part of the reason there's been this waning of allegiance to the lost cause. It's become much harder, I think, for people to kind of play that game that one can honor the Confederacy without honoring its cause, which was the defense of slavery.
Peter messaged us. He says, I grew up in Texas and rural New England. I encountered far more prevalent and indeed virulent racism in New England. Rural, and he puts in brackets, rural New Hampshire, listen to Boston area sports radio, than in Texas. It frankly baffles me that my northern friends, when I contend that race relations are far better in the South than the North, where interaction between the races is essentially parallel play. Another message here from Martin in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He says, while the Southern stereotype is one of quaint or horrifying backwardsness, which is at most only partly true, can you comment on the effect of the recent vast influx of Yankees such as myself? Literally half of my Michigan College fraternity graduating class now live in the former Confederacy. In some parts around here, few people seem to have local accents.
Yes, and that's most noticeable in cities like Austin, where I am now, or Atlanta, or New Orleans, where you've had a particularly noticeable influx of people from the North. And it's certainly changed. It's been, in some ways, added to the economic dynamism. A lot of people coming are opening businesses and other enterprises. And I think it raises the question of what Southern identity is going to mean 10, 20 years ago. I mean, already we've been talking about this sort of attachment to the Civil War and the Confederacy waning, and that's been a defining feature of Southern life, often in a negative way, for a very long time. You have the diet, the accent, and the music, but that's changes too as more and more people come in from elsewhere. So I think that will be an interesting question, whether we will be sitting down 20 years from now talking about the South as a distinct region. It really is in flux.
Sherry from Birmingham emailed us, and she wants to know, did you come to Birmingham? Did you meet or impressive young Mayor Woodfin? Did you eat at the James Beard award-winning Highlands Bar and Grill? Did you go to North Alabama to Florence, the home of Billy Reid and Alabama chain leaders in today's fashion industry? I was born in 1963, she says, and remember how racist people were. And although the remnants of that racism is evident in Alabama, there is great art, music, and food that is helping to move us forward. Did you go to Birmingham?
Yeah. I've been there before. For this book, because I was following Olmsted's path, I went where he went on this voyage. So for this book, no, but I'm very familiar with Alabama. And I think it's really almost displaced Mississippi as the most dumped on state in the Union. It's become a kind of stand-in for many Northerners for what they most despise. And this abortion debate, I think, has reminded us of that again. And so I think, I appreciate that question and that people recognize Alabama, like the rest of the South, isn't all one thing. And that there are certainly places like Birmingham and elsewhere where, a lot of fresh and exciting things are happening.
Now, Tony, you spoke to people also as voters about what their fears and hopes were. What were the major issues on the minds and hearts of folks in some of the spots that you visited?
Yeah, I was traveling really in the 2 years leading up to the 2016 election. I ended my journey at the Mexican border just a couple days before the election. And because I was traveling principally, politically red territory, I did go to major cities, but where Olmsted went tended to be more now rural and small town. So I was hearing, I would say a largely conservative opinion. One thing that struck me was the degree to which Trump's appeal to many people was essentially his raised middle finger to what they perceive as the establishment and the coastal elites. Yes, issues mattered, immigration, many others, but I would often meet people who disagreed with Trump, say, on abortion or a border wall, but just loved, you know, what he was saying and doing, you know, towards those they view as looking down on them. So I think that was a, you know, a fairly important part of that election.
In Kentucky, you visit the Creation Museum and later talk with a Dan Phelps, a paleontologist, who says there's a, quote, tendency to fall back on fake facts and conspiracy, unquote, where he lives. What did you learn about conspiracy theories?
Yeah, I would say this was probably the most dispiriting aspect of my journey. When I wrote Confederates in the Attic, a lot of young blacks were wearing T-shirts saying, you know, with Malcolm X insignias. And white teenagers started wearing T-shirts with a rebel flag and the words, you wear your X and I'll wear mine. It's sort of, you have your history and heroes and I have mine, you know, not common ones. And now it's, you have your truth, you know, and I have mine, a kind of apartheid of the mind. And I'll just give you one quick example. Here in Texas, I spent a week in a very conservative small town, going each morning to a breakfast club where 10 men would sit and discuss the news of the day. And they kept talking about a Muslim compound south of town where jihadists were training. And there had actually been protests about this and demands that something be done. And I said, you know, I used to be a Middle East correspondent. I speak some Arabic. I'll go down there and check it out and report back to you. And to make a long story short, it turned out to be a Pakistani doctor from Houston who had a second home in this county and would occasionally go out with his wife and daughter who covered their hair. And I met the sheriff, you know, a real good old boy named Woody, who said, you know, he's just being driven crazy by these demands. You know, Woody, you got to do something about this. So I went back to the breakfast club feeling vindicated. And, you know, they said, yeah, we know Woody, great guy, you know, went to school with him. And I said, you know, he says there's no there there. And the response was, you know, Woody had to say that. He's being paid by the Muslims to say that. And that's their strategy, to come in quiet and lull people. And we have aerial photographs. And I said, show them to me. And they said, we don't share that with the lying media. So, you know, where do we even start to have conversation about our differences when we can't even, you know, have a shared reality?
Now, people have long mythologized the South. It is certainly far from a monolith, stretching from northern Appalachia down to Mexico. Was that your takeaway, and that it was more diverse than you originally considered?
Well, the South has always been more diverse than people outside the region imagined. But yes, that it's certainly become more so. But I also visited some of the traditional subcultures that aren't new in the South. For instance, Cajun Louisiana, where you can walk into, you know, a diner and not understand a word anybody is saying because the patois is so different. Or the German settlement in the hill country of Texas, where Olmsted spent a lot of time. This is a story that's, you know, completely different from most people's notion of Texas. They were some of the Marxists who settled there in the 1840s. They were fiercely opposed to slavery, and many of them died resisting the Confederacy. So you have these remarkable pockets all across the South, some of them going back hundreds of years, that I think upend some of our notions about the region.
Now, on the conspiracy front, you encountered a particular episode in Texas regarding alleged Muslim compounds. Can you tell us about that?
I think I just spoke to that. Oh. That was at the diner in Crockett. And I heard about it elsewhere in Texas. I kept hearing about these Muslim compounds that, as far as I can tell, simply don't exist.
Now, Olmsted traveled on the eve of the Civil War, and you followed his trail today as the nation becomes redder and bluer, further entrenched in partisanship. Are we at risk of repeating history, Tony?
Yeah, there are certainly frightening echoes of the 1850s in our extreme polarization, our tendency to demonize people on the other side, the seeming paralysis of our very divided government, and in other ways. I don't think we're headed to violent breakup, and I certainly hope not, but I think it's worth listening to those warning signs from the 1850s. And if there's an issue that I think has the potential to drive us even further apart, it's the one you opened the hour with, abortion, because it is one of these issues that is so emotional and so divisive, and there doesn't appear to be any opening for compromise or middle ground. And that was really the situation in the 1850s with slavery. And one of the decisive moments in that lurch to civil war was the Dred Scott decision, which ruled that blacks had no power over their own bodies. They had no rights as American citizens. They weren't citizens. And when I think of Roe v. Wade, being revisited, we have this potential for another explosive debate over now whether women have rights over their bodies when it comes to reproduction.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A. You wrote about an opinion piece, Tony, in the New York Times about this idea of barstool democracy, that perhaps this is the sort of space Americans need to be investing in. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, again, because I followed Olmsted in visiting a lot of taverns and what he called grog shops, as they were known in his day, and sitting down with people and simply talking. And I came away from that experience. I would hardly liken bars to healthy civic spaces, which Olmsted, you know, ends up designing at Central Park and elsewhere. But they are gathering places. I'll just give you one example. And I met a veteran union leader in West Virginia who was bemoaning the fact that, you know, back in the day, people would gather after work at the corner bar and talk politics. You know, and they might also do it at the barbershop and other settings. And he says now everybody's alone in their car or home, kind of listening to their favorite rant, and rather than really engaging with others in a setting like a bar. It's not that people aren't still going to bars, but I think those kind of working men's bars are a diminishing breed. And I think we see it with our candidates who used to routinely, you know, want to be photographed in a bar hoisting a beer, you know, with Joe Sixpack, as he was called. You don't see that as much anymore. And I think there's been a kind of retreat from that space for a variety of reasons, declining industries, changing gender politics. So it's not all to be mourned, but I think it is a good space to have the kind of discussion we've been talking about across our national divide.
Viola emailed us. She says, your experience, as she says, the author, but she's talking about you, Tony, your experience of hospitality would have been very different if you were black, if you were a black person, an immigrant, a woman, or any other minority. Is any truth to that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm a white male. I have a Jewish surname, which really has almost never been an issue in my many years of traveling the South. I think that came home clearest to me when I went to a Baptist church in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans, the Franklin Street Baptist Church.
What happened there?
And, you know, I was one of just a handful of whites there in a very large, just, you know, an unbelievably warm embrace, you know, just such a glow of fellowship, and not just towards me, towards other, you know, whites in the audience. And, you know, one woman I was sitting next to saying, you know, how Dr. King used to say, you know, Sundays were the most segregated, you know, moment Sunday morning in America. And, you know, hopefully that's changing. And I walked out of there absolutely thinking, well, if I had been a black guy wandering into a church in one of the white flight suburbs of New Orleans, you know, how would I have been received? So sure, I don't kid myself that it's as easy to do what I did for others.
Tony, you end your book in Central Park musing on the subject. Did Olmsted's mission work?
Yeah, so he comes away from the South with this mission to create democratic spaces where all can come together and, as he put it, be uplifted. And he saw this really as a rebuke to what he'd seen in the very feudal society of the South. And, you know, a lot has changed since his time, but people still come together in a way that I think makes for a degree of tolerance that might not otherwise be there.
A thanks to our guest, journalist and author Tony Horowitz. He's out with the new book, Spying on the South, An Odyssey Across the American Divide. He's also author of Confederates in the Attic. Remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app or whatever app you like. We'd love it if you'd write us a review. If you're new to podcasts, you'll find all the links to listen online at npr.org/1A. This program was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about her and the other members of the 1A team, visit the 1A.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons.